Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This piece has been brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I am welcoming my former co-host, Patrick Martins, the author of The Carnivore's Manifesto, Eating Well, Eating Responsibly, and Eating Meat. And for those of you who, for some reason, do not know who Patrick Martins is, he is the founder of Heritage Foods USA, a very special distribution company that focuses on livestock breeds that are rare and in danger of extinction. He is also the founder of this very radio station, the Heritage Radio Network, and that's where we met. And he also started the slow food business here in the United States way back when. So welcome to the studio, Patrick. I know you've so rarely been in here.
I'm great at starting things. Finishing, not so much.
You finished the book.
Yes, that I did.
That was a miracle. But, you did have a little help with it. Mike Edison, your co-author.
Yeah, I couldn't have written the book without him. I mean, co-author is very, very important. I think anyone could write a book, if they have a co-author.
Yeah, probably.
There's not a person out there who doesn't have some story if it's pitched right. And, because a co-author's job is just to decorate, kind of be the thread between, these tapestries.
He's the quilting the patches together.
Yeah, that's a big task.
Yeah, so now why did you want to write The Carnivore's Manifesto of all the possibilities of books and stories that you, Patrick Martins, could tell? Why The Carnivore's Manifesto?
Well, I definitely had enough. I've been very lucky. I mean, I met Carlo Petrini in New York in 1998. Then I worked slow food in Italy, and I traveled all around Europe. And then I came to the States. I got to travel all throughout these chapters, Portland, San Francisco, I would go 2, 3, 4 times a year, LA, but also weird little places like, I can't even think. I mean, places like Canvas, in North Carolina,
some of the
towns.
Places where you met the farmers that you ended up working with for Heritage, right?
Kansas City, and all that. So it was just so lucky, and I knew there were all these things, these observations that needed to be, they needed an archive somewhere. They were also very broad, I didn't go that deep in any one subject. It was more just, knowing that there's problems with pigs out there and that, restaurants hate it when this happens. And, as a diner, it's very frustrating when this happens. And then I met Anne and she's like, yes, I've noticed the same thing. But, not that many people think that deeply about food, I guess. They think about it peripherally and sometimes they care about it, but most Americans don't. So I knew there could be potential readership for all these accumulated experiences that I'd had the luck of interacting with.
Well, one of the chapters that I really enjoyed was towards the end when you have a sort of a letter to would-be restaurateurs.
And it's a letter to farmers, actually.
A letter to farmers. But how do you deal with these people and know that you are going to have to actually produce the same thing over and over again, that there's got to be some consistency. And that makes me want to talk.
The whole local movement suffers from that.
Yeah.
I mean, the local food movement, there are a couple things wrong with it, just in New York City I can speak to. Mm-hmm. But also, I think the same would apply to Ferry Plaza and Vermont.
Sure.
They end up being very Republican places. They fall into the category of being very conservative. They are not about growing things because they have it all. I mean, the farmers at the Union Square Farmers Market, the farmers at the Ferry Plaza, guess what? They're not into huge changes. They sell to some of the most affluent Americans in the country.
That's right. And they can
they sell it out all the time. There's literally 10 million people going through their stall every week. So do they want to see 70 other meat farmers start? No. Do the solderhouses want to see 10,000 other solder? No, because they're full. Their cup runneth over. Mm-hmm. So as a result, they become the ones most resistant to change and advancing things because they are holding it. And that's why I think the food world is more exciting in places like, Madison, Wisconsin, where it's more a hippie kind of all people on board. It's also funny. I mean, this kind of doesn't really connect, but we were in Berkeley. Yeah. And we got yelled at twice for crossing the street. Mike Edison, my co-writer, was like, I can't wait to go back to New York City where I'll feel safe crossing the streets again. And what happened is...
Why? Because you were jaywalking?
Well, we weren't. On one hand, the woman was like, cross the street, pedestrians, you know, even though she had the green light and we had the red light. I'm like, wow, you guys give way too much power to pedestrians if you override basic traffic laws.
Right.
And the point is, it's something that started as a hippie thing. Everybody, we're easygoing. What ends up happening over years and years, all these rules get created about what it means to be a hippie. And then in the end, you have the most non-hippie uptight zone in the history of the planet. And I think that relates back to what I was saying about the farmers. Just a little bit, so many rules about what it means to be cool or okay with the business and this and that.
Well, I think you make a great observation. And once again, you surprise me, Patrick. But I suspect that you're exactly right, which is that, you know, when you have a bunch of people who have figured out what they think is the right way, mm-hmm. then suddenly there's rules about the right way. And people who aren't doing it that way are doing it the wrong way, mm-hmm. even if it might be a good way. Yeah. So, but with that being said, let's talk just for a second about heritage breeds and how, you know, what does that all mean and why is it important? Just like, let's get that out of the way for people who maybe haven't necessarily tuned into why heritage breeds matter.
Well, just like there are many types of dogs and cats in the world, there are also many types of livestock species. They
right.
come from certain places. They have their histories. They also have their own particular genetics. And for all those reasons, it's important to preserve those breeds because they are part of our history, just like our art history, our architecture history. They're also, their genetics could hold valuable solutions to resisting man-made or natural pathogens that come along, like the Irish potato famine. And plus, also, if we're going to really look to meat the way we do vegetables, I mean, any recipe book will write pages and pages and pages on the seeds and the heirloom seeds and the vegetable and the provenance of the vegetable and this and that. And then 32-ounce flank steak.
Right.
You know, that's it. And the meat has nothing. So it's important to preserve also the gastronomic traditions behind these breeds, because if we're going to ask them to die for us, you know, we shouldn't just treat them as one, under one umbrella. Yes, they all have differences. They taste different. I mean, Kobe beef from Kenina beef, from Angus beef, these are all important things. So you have to eat them in order to save them, unlike wild animals that you just leave alone to run around in order
and
to
reproduce,
increase their populations. You need to eat these animals and give farmers the incentives to raise them. So we try to save rare breeds through sales. And we have about 120 restaurants that buy from us every week, about 30,000 people around the country who get FedEx packages delivered directly to their home through our excellent mail order company. So that's how you actually intervene on behalf of farmers, is you buy from them. That's how you help endanger breeds of livestock, the kinds that taste the best, the kind that are pasture raised, the kind that are not these factory farm freaks, which I hate to say it, but they're freaks being raised on those farms. Temple Grandin says it. Frank Reese says it. I mean, I'm not the only one on some plank out there saying that they are abusing the animals that they raise. They are. I think that's generally understood. It's why I also think this book might not get the attention it deserves, because when you take on Purdue and Smithfield directly by name for what they're doing to the animals, you know, even great publications that you would think would be immune to sponsors and boards of directors and this and that, mm-mm. still might be a touch resistant.
Just a touch. Absolutely.
They potentially lose money.
Yeah, although the meat racket, Chris Leonard's book, names Tyson. It's a deconstruction of the Tyson business model and how it's had an impact on livestock ag throughout this country and throughout the world. And he got plenty of splay. So I don't think you should worry too much about that. But let's talk a little bit about, the elitism that is often thrown at people like you, or, you know, the farmers market model and stuff like that, mm-hmm. where it's like not available to everyone. It's too expensive, blah, blah, blah.
Well, you know, I mean, I'll answer
should
that.
Should we be
just
eating $140 turkeys? Is that really true?
I'll eat this. I'll just answer for meat. Mm-hmm. So it's just, and through the lens of meat, all food, yes, of course, people need to be able to afford food. I actually think that because we are so anti commodity, and by the way, it's not a utopic book. This is about a slow turning of the wheel. I had a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich for breakfast today, and excellent. I know that that bacon came from a cruel system.
And you know those eggs did too.
Right. This is about a slow turning of the wheel. So, I say in the book, one of the chapters, that this might actually be one of the greatest vegetarian manifestos of all time, because basically it's anti the corporate agriculture, which for many reasons that you could read in the book, it's 53-page essays. You see why that's happening, how that's happening. Some people, some you know, like confinement, they never see the light of day. Other things you might not have thought about, the whole being able to pursue their curious instincts. Pigs are very smart animals. Two, survival of the fattest chapter, which is chapter three. These animals are bred to grow so fast. These profit people who are the boards of directors have gotten so good at raising these animals in half the time that it takes that they actually arrived to the slaughterhouse already injured. Temple Grandin just 2 weeks ago came out with she said it in a speech somewhere that about, you know, 30% of all chickens arrived to the plant before anything else already injured because they were being forced to grow too fast. So you know, we know about that. Now the $140 turkey, which we're just talking about meat, you know, when you think about what the alternative is, and I'll say this in under 30 seconds, their beaks get clipped.
You don't have to talk that fast.
No, but I mean, this is the answer. Why $140 turkey? Because the $2 a pound turkey, as opposed to the $10 a pound turkey, its beak was clipped so that it could not fulfill its natural instinct to be a picky eater. It was not given its natural food. It was given antibiotic-ridden mush, you know, which helps it grow. They never turn the lights off in those barns. So that
they eat all day.
They are never allowed to see the light of day. They are over-confined, and they are obese. That's what they have gotten good at. They've made all these animals obese so that they could have more white breast meat to sell. And then sometimes they even dump the shit of all these animals in rivers and pay a relative pittance.
Not sometimes. They spread that manure over fields and it runs into the groundwater and the waterways.
So who are we telling to eat that turkey to?
Yeah.
Who are we making the argument for? That is classist. It's the exact opposite. People say this with goodwill. Oh, because I am a caring, understanding person. That's why I say, poor person, eat this. Eat this cheap food. Eat this cheap meat. That is the absolute opposite of what you need to be telling anyone. Because if there's a truth out there, that truth applies to everybody, whether you're rich or poor, black or white. And maybe you need to be eating less meat. Or maybe you need to be doing it Italian style, where you dribble 2 ounces of ground, delicious, healthy meat onto a pasta and eating that for $3. By the way, even at $140, that's $10 a person.
Right.
That's a pound a person for a 14-pound turkey. That $10 a person is not that much out of touch with what a McDonald's value meal costs, which might be $7, $6, you know, so what, $4 more? I mean, you're not talking about it costing $300 a pound. I'm also sick of hearing all the people are constantly criticizing, like Armandino Batali's salumi, which we sell at our Heritage Meat Shop, $28 a pound. Have you seen what a proper portion is? It comes to 80 cents. No, it does. When you slice the salami very thin
which
and eat it as an appetizer, that's under a dollar. And even Anne, who runs one of the best cheese shops in the country, you know, all Vermont cheeses, she herself sometimes feels this guilt of saying, wow, this is $32 a pound. As an appetizer, you're not supposed to eat the whole wheel.
Right.
You're supposed to eat a little triangle that comes to $2. So anyway, it's just to say this elitist argument ends up, what it does is it demeans poor people.
Right.
And it tells them something that's not true, when in reality, they are being complicit in a crime. If that company is dumping the shit into a river or spreading it around, why would a poor person not have the ethical desire to not do the wrong thing? And again, we're not a utopic society. This book, it's very realistic. It's about a slow turning of the wheel, but you cannot have dual arguments for different people.
Yeah, no, I'm into that.
So it is very weird that people don't get that.
Well, of
it's
course
very
not,
condescending.
Because the upfront costs seem outrageous because the back costs are not being advertised in commodity farming.
It's still not right for anybody to be eating those foods, and they should be told to avoid it. whenever possible.
Whenever possible.
And I'm only talking about meat. I'm not talking about fruits and vegetables and basic grains. I mean, people deserve a nutritious environment.
But the case for commodity is kind of a strong case, which is that, first of all, lots of environmental studies will show that you actually have a smaller carbon footprint with some of these operations because you're not using as much land.
But the animals are abused.
Not always.
Why?
I don't think that is widespread.
Pigs?
Pigs, I agree, should
Chickens.
Not be. Yeah,
that's
but
it.
Let's
Those
talk
are two
about
big
cows.
Ones.
Okay, and then let's talk about also the ability to provide the consistent product that every American seems to want. They all want exactly the same size.
I don't
they want
know
the
they
same
all
eye.
Want.
I do. I think people. They. That's why brands are successful.
Yeah.
If somebody is marketing a brand and the brand is successful, it's because people know that that's going to represent certain qualities that they have come to cherish about that brand.
That
rightly
doesn't
or
get
wrongly.
Lost in the other system.
You don't think so?
No. I mean,
How
charming.
Do you
there might.
Standardized old Gloucester Old Spot pigs.
Well, I mean, standard. There might be charming inconsistencies.
I love you said charming inconsistencies quite a few
no,
times
there
in the
might
book.
Be
I
some,
thought that was great. Charming inconsistencies.
There might be, you know, and also, what is this? Someone really looking within a tenth of an inch
well,
of
your
fat
restaurant,
for a pork chop?
Your restaurant clients are looking for consistency.
And we give them.
Yeah, you
All
are able to give them. How does
the,
that? How do you do that? I guess that's my question.
I guess,
how do you make that work?
I don't want to answer that exactly because it's a very complicated question.
Mm-hmm.
We need more farms producing more food for more Americans.
Right.
That's the goal of this book, and it talks about it in very concrete ways. It's a roadmap for accomplishing that. Now, you're saying, you know, will people in Oregon be upset that their, you know, breakfast sausage doesn't taste the same as the guy in Ohio? No. I mean, in fact, I was amazed. We went to Oregon. They have, in a large part, they were like Purdue, Smithfield. They haven't infiltrated there. California, the West Coast, is like a weird thing. They already are doing different things.
Yes.
Their chicken, I forget, Foster Farms, I believe, was the name of their chicken.
Yeah, the one with the big recall for salmonella
yeah.
last year. Yeah.
They don't do Purdue there because it's like a separate island, that country. So, I mean,
yeah.
there are already inconsistencies between commodity products.
Mm-hmm.
The breakfast sausage that does well on the East Coast doesn't necessarily do well on the West Coast. There might be another company doing that. So, you know, I think there are already differences. And I think, you know, the North
Carolina.
Well,
of course there are, but I'm saying that the brand represents a specific ideal.
Well,
so
we do.
Somebody
we are
who wants
pro-brand.
Jimmy Dean's is going to buy a Jimmy Dean's versus, you know, an Armandino Batali salumi. You know what I mean?
Well, yes, you have to so compare like things to like things.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, we are pro. I mean, like, you know, Coca-Cola, unless you can make a better Coca-Cola, why would you try? People
yeah.
should drink Coca-Cola unless you're going to. I've never tasted at a restaurant a ketchup that tastes better than Heinz.
Yeah.
So there's no reason to do it.
And nobody likes anything better than Hellman's. I don't
yeah.
know. I don't eat mayonnaise. So
but
I,
when
you
know. A turkey is not allowed to sleep the way it does in nature, all bets are off. And then the answer to all your questions is
yes,
it can happen. Yes, it should happen. Yes, it will. But we can never be like, yes, we abuse animals. It would be like abusing animals in zoos. And you say, yes, but people like the zoo. Time out. If that lion is in the cage the size of a bathtub, it's all bets are off. How do we create the solution? And you ask a very good question. You ask a question in the very same way that every sustainable food conference does. So you're not alone. But what ends up happening then is a bunch of intellectuals are discussing something other than the alternative.
Right.
They are not discussing a pro alternative. I'm very excited. Slow Food is organizing a thing in Denver called Slow Meat.
Yes.
They are trying to get into the old Carlo Petrini thing. It took them 15 years to do it again.
Yes.
I did one with the turkey project, but it's called the
yeah.
Presidium. Active interventions on behalf of meat. Slow Money tried to do that and failed. I cannot think of one project. I do not know of one project that they've done successfully, although I'm sure they'll tell you they've done 10. But, you know, people need to be about the solution.
Yeah.
Some intellectual, oh, well, would this really be a thing? Let's start one project at a time and build from there.
Uh-huh.
So can our food feed the world? I'm not ready to answer that question. And by the way, if I had to, yes, it could.
Right.
How's that? You know, the big companies could change a little bit. And also the current company system is not feeding the whole world anyway right now. So all those things are wrong. And also it's why I hope my book is successful, because it says no offense, Katie, I mean, you love me, but those types of questions are just not right or helpful. Or they're the questions people ask. But they're all wrong. Another thing people say is that $140 turkey is elitist. What's the correct? It's the opposite.
Uh-huh.
And those questions, what's right? The opposite.
Yeah.
Not just a shade of it. It's the opposite. How do we start? Where do we go? What do I put my money to? Where's the CSA I should sign up with? I love Just Food. They're an all CSA organization.
Yeah.
That's big.
All right. We're going to take a short break and do a quick sponsor drop. And then we'll be back with Patrick Martin to talk more about the Carnivore's Manifesto and the creed of Patrick Martin's.
Simple to gourmet, nothing's fresher or tastier in recipes than homegrown, vine-ripened veggies and savory herbs. Do you grow your own? With Bonnie Plants, a kitchen garden at your back door or in containers can produce an amazing harvest for cooking and for sharing. Find how-tos, plans, and more at BonniePlants.com. Your recipes might not change, but your results sure will. Fresh, healthy Bonnie veggies and herbs. Get growing.
We are back. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, Katie Kiefer. My guest is Patrick Martins.
Your former co-host.
My former co-host and the current author of The Carnivore's Manifesto, Eating Well, Eating Responsibly, and Eating Meat. And if anybody knows anything about eating responsibly raised meat, I think it would be Patrick Martins. Because after all, you were kind of the first big kahuna who was literally buying and distributing heritage breeds of meat long before anybody thought it was trendy or
There's still no one who does it on a national level.
Right.
That's upsetting.
It's crazy. I don't understand why you don't have a million copycats.
I mean, we do, I think, on local levels, for sure.
Sure.
And, you know, when I was at Soul Food, we helped launch about 80 independent local supplies of turkeys, where if they couldn't get their shit together, I would personally organize the sale.
That's right.
How, you know, to Tammy Lax's restaurant in Madison, in Montana, the guy couldn't organize the sale, so I would just, you know, sell them by forcing a restaurant to friggin' buy them for $600. You can help a farm. I mean, but no. I mean, we want more competition. It would be correct that there be more competition, but that's what I was saying.
It would also help farmers, and it would drive the prices down if there was a more of a market for this.
I don't think it would drive the prices down.
I think if there was an economy of scale here, you might lose some of the price point.
But if the people want to make a profit and live decent
lives,
then the prices shouldn't go down. What we need to be talking about is cooking in smarter ways, like pasta is a great
using mechanism. Less meat and feeding more people with less meat.
Eat pasta 5 days a week.
Sure.
Italy does it. They live longer, and it comes to $3 a person, even if you end up putting, calamari in it or clams or scallops. It still comes to $3 or $4 a person.
Absolutely. Or beans, for God's sake.
But to say that Frank Rees should grow 10 times as many turkeys and get paid half as much, no. It doesn't happen like that. You're talking about the efficiencies of scale shaves 10, 20, 30 cents off of an 8-pound thing. It does not shave half. So that's also another argument. I do not bring that up in the book, but we need to relieve the pressure of small family farmers to already have to cut prices if they can double in size. No. A few cents maybe, but... I think it's a mistake.
Well, I think that the smaller family farms are not getting the subsidies that larger farms are getting
through
all these various programs, crop insurances, and especially the fact that that they don't pay any of the back end costs like pollution control, waste disposal, et cetera.
So then because we can't win that fight, because winning that fight is out of our hands.
Right.
We live with what we have, and our meats are priced just fine. Heritage Foods meats are priced just fine.
I think they're pretty recent.
And they're still outrageous to most Americans. But the correct way to look at it is they're within striking distance of what every American can afford. Again, it depends. If you're talking about a 32-ounce ribeye steak, no. then no, we're not going to try to be that game.
Yeah.
But by selling more ground hamburger meat, that ribeye, by the way,
would. Well, let's talk about ground meat, because I'm actually right now negotiating with some guy who runs the company that distributes Five Burger, or what is it, Five Guys?
Five Napkin Burger?
There's all these new chains. There's Mel's, there's Five Napkins, there's Five Guys, mm-hmm. there's Burger BRGR. We should be eating tons more ground meat than we are. So, because so much of the cow and so much of the other animals is wasted through not eating more of it. So how do you propose to make more ground meat products, more, what do you think would make Americans more likely to eat more, say, ground goat, ground lamb, ground turkey?
Well, I don't know that in the book we cover the, if we want a domestic lamb and goat market to grow so that we're not importing it all frozen from New Zealand on big ships. And if we want to see more 100% grass-fed burger, grass-fed cattle operations grow, then, the way to do that is to eat more ground meat.
Yeah.
Another thing we do, we have a Sex Sells Every Season Has Its Meat.
Yeah, yeah. I liked that chapter.
It's
that
basically saying that meats are seasonal, just like fruits and vegetables. Many meats
That's
are.
That's an interesting observation.
We need to be, in order to, let's say it's Goat-tober and we're eating goat, you shouldn't make just one lavish meal with goat and say we've participated in Goat-tober. It's about bringing in a half goat and making, pasta five nights with the ground. Then once you do the belly and you have a weird kind of thing with rice on it, and then another time you do this and you make seven or eight meals using goat.
Yeah,
or
you know what the
turkey.
Problem with all of this is, though, Patrick, is that you are making the assumption that everyone either knows how to cook or has the time to cook. And this is where you and I have always had a bone of contention, because, as you know, I firmly believe that cooking should be back in the school curriculum. And you've always often said in the past that, who needs to cook? You can go out and get meatballs at the meatball shop. It's much better, and it's quicker, and it's easier, and it's cheaper, and blah, blah, blah. So
you're saying
everybody should cook now, and I'm saying that's quite a 180-degree shift for you.
Well, I basically said,
is that because you're married
meat.
Now and
no,
have
no.
children?
Eating ground meat is the way to do it. Everybody can make hamburger, meatballs, and pasta sauce, 100%. So let's grind up all the animals, and rather than say... let me try to support the sustainable food movement.
Right.
Let's
buy one
belly.
Meal. Right.
Yeah. And by buying the belly to help. No, let's buy ground meat all the time. And all those meals that I just said, you should be buying these animals in bulk. You could grind up the whole animal. That's okay too. You buy three lamb for you and your family.
Yeah.
And they come in 171 pound bags of lamb that you're going to eat over the next 3 months.
Yeah.
That's a smart way of doing it. You're going to have a dinner party. You're going to go, 20 people are coming over.
Right.
That
you
one,
bring a gift.
And then you're only trying to do one thing, is grinding up the animal.
Yeah.
But, I didn't really get how to get Americans to do it, but I talk about the importance of, and I don't know if any of those places that you just mentioned, do they have a lamb burger or goat
I don't
burger?
Know, but I'm thinking it's something that you should look into and start talking to them about. Because,
Moo Burger does.
Because why not have a goat burger, I think that's a very good way to move more of that product. And it's also a great way to introduce it to the American population, which isn't so keen on eating goats or insects or any of the other things.
But they love hamburgers and meatballs.
They do.
And that's how it should be, Matt. Support my local farm.
Mm-hmm.
Support lamb. Eat a burger.
Right.
Have a burger party versus what's the top down. Oh, there's 90 ways to braise a trotter. That's ridiculous. I mean, as a national way to do it, that's great for the high-end restaurants. But yes, play the game that exists, which is burgers, hot dogs. That's what
people
want.
Like ground meat, and it's cheap.
Yep, it's the cheapest
it's
way.
It's what can be affordable for even people who don't have a lot of income to dispose on on sort of high-end meats.
Mm-hmm.
But they can certainly afford a six-pack of burgers, whether
there
it's goat, lamb, or...
There should be a National Pasta Day.
Yeah.
Just like there's a National Farmer's Day I call for in Chapter 41. August 1st.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, Jimmy Carbone, one of our co-hosts, is organized with the Green Market to do an official something or other this August 1st.
Is that right?
In an effort to push that through, at least in the state of New York.
That's a great
idea.
That
stupid groundhog gets more attention than our farmers.
I know. It's so true. It's ridiculous. And especially in the last few years, farmers have taken such a beating with those storms. And people forget so quickly, but there was Irene, and then there was Sandy, and then we've had massive flooding. I mean,
what did all of those things have in common? Not one food section in any or magazine covered those issues.
Yeah.
It's all the more reason for the Heritage Radio Network.
That's right. Because there is no voice for the farmer outside of this. Or if you're in the Midwest and you're working with the mainstream farm belt media, which there is. There's Feedstuffs. There's all these other,
and
there's radio stations for them. But there's not like this. And they aren't. And they are speaking only to their own constituencies.
Yes, just like are too here in New York.
Yeah, but they're not speaking to the consumer. They're speaking to other farmers. Mm-hmm. And I think the important thing is, as you say in that chapter, is to remind people of who is actually doing what we all need to survive. One of the things that also interested me was you talk about changing from monocropping breeds into offering more opportunities for different breeds in a more, shall we say, commoditized version. And what would it take for a company like Cargill to move away, say, from, Blank Angus or Smithfield to move away from the large white pig, which is their standard breed?
Well, I mean, what it would take is probably a very slow turning of the wheel. Mm-hmm. It would be, artificially inseminating some purer genetics into the system. There's no sex on these large farms. They're all AI'd. So they have complete power.
Well, even small farms use AI. Come on.
Well, I think the first thing you would say is you cannot feed antibiotics to your food anymore. It would be nice if the market dictates.
I think the market is going to dictate that.
So then
that's
therefore they
now
have to do it. That's the answer right there.
Yeah.
It's through the winnable goal of that one thing. No antibiotics in our food. And then their response privately in their boardroom is like, all our animals are going to die if we don't give them the antibiotics. They won't even get to the end of their short, miserable life. What's the answer? Well, we need to get some of the good old-fashioned Duroc into that.
That's right.
And they're like, but do you know what that's going to mean? Yes, that meat's going to cost more. That's
right.
The end result. After all is said and done, it's going to mean that they have smaller litters. They grow slower.
Yeah.
And that they
and they require more space in which to grow.
A touch, but that's also going to be a battle that's won. In fact, this is a crossover, but I think one day there's going to be a movement for fish to be treated humanely. The whole sea world. No one really speaks on behalf of, we do population counts.
Yeah.
But we don't talk about fairness. Like there's no, hey, what about lobsters that get boiled while they're alive? That's not fair. No one's really fighting that bandwagon. But you know what I think will be the vehicle? The one sea creature that will get people to care?
The dolphin?
Yes, actually. But that hasn't worked yet. The octopus.
Yeah.
As that starts to get
eaten
more and more.
I mean, cuttlefish also are very smart.
Very smart.
And actually, there was a piece in the Times the other day about fish being more intelligent than people have thought in the past and having a much more of a complex social system and emotional life. And I certainly think that's true. I think that the whole assumption that humans are the only sentient beings on the planet is so incredibly wrongheaded and small-minded that it just kind of boggles the mind.
But I do think that that's the thing. They will get the genetics in out of circumstance. Their animals are sick. And they're going to need to weave in some better genetics. And I think, ironically, this sounds crazy, they're going to come to guys like Craig Good or perhaps some of the farmers in their own network that keep side supplies of stronger genetics, ones that were not engineered for one trait at the expense of all others. And they're just going to start, and those animals will be healthier.
Hey, Patrick, have you visited that place in Newport that is preserving semen and eggs?
Yes, in Massachusetts.
I thought it was in Newport.
Well, there's more than one Newport.
Newport, Rhode Island.
Or Rhode Island?
Yeah.
Is that the Metcalf family?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they have that whole, it's like Amy Goodman's, Amy Goodman, Amy, the one who does all the heirloom vegetables up in
the Metcalfs are doing very important stuff. Like, that's a way to preserve it. They're just.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's like one of the best ways, just like people who buy up land.
Yeah.
To preserve
it. And put it into the nature trust. Yeah.
Those are the best ways. That's why we have an article about Ted Turner.
Yes.
He's done conservation easement on.
He's got the bison thing.
Millions of acres.
So now the book is very funny. by
Thank
the way.
You.
Yeah, it's
so
really...
you want to know how that happened? That was Mike Edison.
I'm no, all serious. You're pretty funny.
I'm serious all the time.
Well, one of my favorite...
This is the most jokey I've ever been.
No, it isn't. In fact, you're frighteningly serious right now. I hope you weren't this serious on your
this
book
is the
tour.
Politico show of the network.
Yeah, well, I know, but I mean, fiery. Still, we can have a few giggles here.
Okay.
No, but share the shit was one of my absolute all time favorite chapters in the book because
but it wasn't
something
a very
that I
intellectual
talk,
chapter.
No, it's not. But it's but my favorite line in it was until they start mailing toxic hog turds along with their dividends, arguing in terms of shareholder value is not an acceptable excuse. I just thought that was absolutely brilliant. Freaking brilliant.
Yeah.
And also so accurate. It's like these big companies get away with murder.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
in terms
these companies
of,
are bad, you know, companies. And I was just talking with Sam Edwards. People don't care anymore. They don't, they're not stirred into action. In the 60s, you
yeah,
know,
activism is not a big part of
we're
our
culture.
We're
watching the 60s. Oh my God. Civil rights, you know, wars. You know, you weren't born yet, Katie, but you know.
Wait a minute. I'm the million, I'm the
it's
million
the opposite
year old
with
woman.
You. See, I've changed. I have a one of the chapters. Mike Edison was a real master. He's the host of Arts and Seizures
with Judy McGuire. Yeah. Great
and
show.
He was great at finding quotes, all the 50 chapters of
yes,
quotes.
Yes, they have wonderful quotes.
And my favorite is Somerset Maugham. Excess on occasion is exhilarating. It prevents moderation from acquiring the deadening effect of a habit.
Bravo.
Yeah, no, it's it was a very fun book to write, and I only felt that I would ever write one book. I mean, a recipe book doesn't count.
Please.
But the last thing the world needs is that. Although I will, if the advance is right, be happy to dive into the kitchen.
Yeah, sure.
No, I wouldn't really be doing it. I might conceive of what the book should be. But this
you could do
the
a meat book.
Book,
but there's a lot of meat books out there.
So what did you honestly think about it? You who read so much. Carnivore's Manifesto, Mike Edison, Patrick Martin's. Where does it fall in the pantheon?
In the pantheon. Well, I wouldn't say that it was up there with Middlemarch, my favorite book of all time, but definitely a great read, really fun to read, informative, especially if you're not steeped in the lore of the meat industry as I am.
Is it one of the top 500 food books written this year?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
I'd say maybe
Katie,
in the top
thanks.
15
what?
Of the food books written this year.
Decade?
No, I think everybody should get this book and read it because it's fun and easy to read. It takes just a couple hours to buzz through it. It brings up a lot of very interesting points. I thought it was well done.
Thanks, Katie.
Now, where can people find you? Are you going to be speaking anywhere in the New York area? Are you doing any more book tour? We didn't even
we
talk
just did,
about
I
the
know.
Book
we
tour.
Had a great book tour. We did, we, you know, Alice Waters was so kind to us. You brought up school lunch as mm-hmm. important thing. She's pushing that. She just had lunch with the new president of Cal State, which is Janet Napolitano.
Oh, excellent.
And they're making headway to change the food system of that university, and that could mean, you know, have a domino effect.
Oh, a lot of the universities are changing because Sodexo is supplying a lot of these university mm-hmm. meals, and many of them are switching over into more sustainable.
I would like you to do that cutoff, you know, of where that is, because mm-hmm. I know that they are doing good mm-hmm. stuff, and Chipotle, too.
Yep.
And I 100% believe it, and I tell everybody it is. But they're like, well, what does that mean exactly when it comes to the meats?
It would be interesting to find out how many pounds of meat they are buying from quote-unquote sustainably raised sources.
Well, sustainably raised is what would be interesting if your show yeah. covered. Like, what is the good? Is that pen size? Is it number of animals per
right.
acre? Like,
oh, how to define that?
Yes, how to define good so that there could be that middle zone reward for companies that are quite large but are doing stuff much
but are
better
doing it
than
better.
Other companies.
Well, like the pup companies, obviously, like Nyman Ranch, for instance, that that Chipotle is buying their pork from. And Paul Willis is way out ahead of the game with
he
his
was.
Pork products.
It still is. But, I mean, what is that standard? So that person mm-hmm. in Oregon who is trying to break ground from his, you know, shitty
right, and wants to market
food,
on this level.
What are the rules, the standards? Is
right.
there a template?
And, I don't know that answer.
But it would be interesting
would
for your show over years to cover that because yeah. it is defining the new commodity.
That's right.
The sustainable one.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And those precise, hard numbers are tough.
Well, in the industry, the commodity industry is making a lot of noise about following that, and they have something called the Global Roundtable for Sustainable Beef Production, which I've covered a couple of times. And interestingly, it does not include a single player from Australia, one of the world's greatest beef production countries in the world. And they have a very sustainable grass-fed model because they have so much prairie. You know, I think it's just fascinating. I'm actually going to Australia in August.
What?
Yeah, Food Arts is sending me.
So how are you going to do your show?
Remotely.
Who's your Joan Rivers? My Joan Rivers was Mike Edison.
I need a Joan Rivers. I really do.
Yeah.
Anyway, we have to cut this off, but do you have any events coming up in New York?
In New York, yes. Well, I'm going to be on Mike Colomeco's show.
Excellent.
Mike Edison. There's a Carnivores Manifesto website that lists this stuff. There's something on July 2nd that he is doing music with. He's a master theremin player,
yes,
micro writer. And there's going to be other events.
So they can check
articles.
It out on the carnivoresmanifesto.com?
Yes, I think so.
You think? I think you
.org? It's certainly not.
I don't think it's a .org. This is a for-profit venture, right?
They would never do .us.
I don't think so. anyway, Patrick, thanks a lot for joining me today.
Thanks.
This was fun. It was great to have you on the show.
I'm like your Marv Albert. Whenever your guests cancel, I'm on.
Okay, great. It's a deal. Not that that ever happens. All right. Thanks to my sponsor and thanks to my engineer. And we'll see you next week. We'll be talking with, I can't remember who, but somebody good. I promise. See you then. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.